Welcome to the Love and Respect Podcast, a conversation that changes the way you view all relationships, whether married, single, parent, or professional. Discover the relationship secret hidden in plain sight. And now the intersection of theology and psychology. Conversations between pastor
and psychologist.
They are father and son. Your hosts, Emerson and Jonathan Egerich.
Are you ready?
Here we go.
Welcome to the Love and Respect Podcast. I'm Jonathan Egerich, here with my father, Emerson Egerich. So glad that you could join us this week for episode 113 of the podcast, which is titled, Why Confess Our Unloving and Disrespectful Comments, which we'll jump to in a moment. If you haven't had a chance to check out last week's episode, Why Do I Rebel Against Being Kind, Loving, and Respectful? You can do that, as always, in a variety of places, including our website, the blog, going to loveandrespectpodcast.com, downloading our app, which is available for all mobile platforms, or going to places like iTunes and other places that feed podcast episodes and things like that. I know many of you do a variety of those things. Again, there's probably 23,500 or so downloads of our app to date, so we know many of you engage it through that. Also related to the app, we announced it for the kind of the first time last week about being able to give in there, donate in there. Thank you so much for those of you that gave over the past week. We're appreciative. Many of you did one-time donations from small to quite large, and a few of you gave weekly, monthly, or yearly, which is easy to set up in there. So I just wanted to, again, thank you for that. No pressure to do so, but that will always be available in the app to do, and you know, feel free to do so if you choose. But we're entering the fall season. If those of you are considering doing a small group, you know, as a study as a couple, a study as a small group, or a study through your church and haven't decided on a topic yet, we do have 4 small group offerings that are available at our store. You know, we always notice kind of an uptick at this time of the year and people beginning those and purchasing those. So head over on over to loveandrespect.com in the store. If you haven't, you know, decided on something yet, or this is prompting, yeah, maybe we should do a study through our church or invite people from our neighborhood over to do something on the topic of marriage in relationships. So we'd be happy if you did so. And our staff is happy to answer any questions if you wonder which one you should choose. But as we move forward today, I'll turn it over to you, Dad, for, you know, this topic of, you know, confessing inside of relationships.
Well, and as, you know, we think of this topic on confession, you know, I remember the Fonz. This would, do you remember Happy Days, Jonathan? Does that ever ring a bell with you, that sitcom? Mm-hmm. And the Fonz, and sure. It wasn't one of the things that I watched on a regular basis, but I can remember the Fonz, who's one of the lead characters there. You know, he'd get himself in a pickle where, you know, he had done something wrong, and he was cornered to the point where he needed to make confession, and he would then say, "I was." He could never say he was wrong. It just didn't come out of his mouth. It just couldn't and wouldn't come out. And, you know, but it's the reason we laugh at it is because most of us are that way. We are, you know, put into a situation where we've done wrong. And, you know, there's really only one way to begin to get out of that, and that's by making confession. But, the ability we have to, in some ways, you know, justify not doing that is incredible. And I want us to take a look at the importance of confessing those moments where we've been unloving or disrespectful in our comment toward, you know, a spouse or in the family unit or wherever. And I will tell you that if you're like me, if you're aware of the fact that you need to do this, it's not going to come out of your lips easily. You're going to say, I was wrong. And it's not an easy thing to do. So this is not particularly inviting, but the upside on this is incredible. And I here's where we want to start. If the roles were reversed and someone had been very, you know, unloving and disrespectful to you, they were harsh, they were angry, they had a disdainful look, and you felt like, wow, that was an overreaction. And as we pointed out quite often, the conflicts that we have that hurt us the deepest are it's really not the discussion about money. It's not the discussion about sex. It's not the topic. It's the person's reaction to us when we're addressing that topic. So, you know, the husband says, you know, what'd you do with that money? You know, and it's that unloving reaction. Or, you know, she says, you want sex again? And so there is this negativity that quenches us. And so we're offended. And so what if they don't apologize? What if they say, get over it? You're just too hypersensitive. I'm not going to apologize. I'm not going to confess anything. You know, I mean, we are appalled. I mean, why don't they just say, I'm sorry? You know, I mean, hey, I was out of line there. I overreacted. I mean, so we all know that when we are the victim of someone who has been unloving or disrespectful, that we expect them, you know, to humbly apologize. I mean, we want to say, wow, can't you at least just say you're sorry? I mean, for your part. So we know the golden rule. I mean, if I expect that of others, then what justification or rationalization do I have in not extending it? And are we really like the Fonz in that sense? Does that sound like a fair introduction, Jonathan?
Yeah, it does. And I guess one of the questions I have, maybe probably all of this would apply beyond what you're talking about, but it sounds like you're talking kind of about the day-to-day interactions inside of marriage versus confession that comes, you know, post an affair or something like that. Is that what you're talking about, these day-to-day opportunities to say we're sorry and will you forgive me and move on?
Both. Yeah, and that's a good clarification. Both. I mean, these concepts apply with the small infractions, and they apply to the huge immoral transgressions. Yeah, no, that's a good clarification. So, you know, you don't want to be superficial in saying one size fits all, but, you know, if there's a continuum of wrongdoing, and I mean, in our minds, do we have this idea that if I only go 30% along the continuum in terms of wrongdoing, I give myself a pass. I don't have to confess. It's only when I hit 31% that I need to get serious about this. And I'm pointing out, hey, if we know that we came across in an unloving and disrespectful way, or we even recognize this good-willed person in our life who cares for us is kind of deflated over the way in which we reacted, we can either dismiss them as being immature and hypersensitive that we talked about, or we can give them the benefit of the doubt and just say, hey, my bad. You know, I was wrong. And we're going to get into the idea here today as well, is we're not saying that they're not guilty for something. We're going to point out, and we'll repeat it, we're only owning it up to our part. If they're 70% guilty and I'm 30%, we're talking about me focused on my 30%. That's what a mature person does. And some of us say, well, I'm not going to apologize for my, you know, 30% if they don't acknowledge their 70%. And we all get that because that's not fair. But one of the challenges for us is to own up to our side and leave the results to God and let the other person deal with their stuff. And we're going to point out that when we do the confession, though, it usually brings the other person under conviction. We don't do it for that reason. But that is the natural result. It's just human nature. I mean, when someone humbles themselves before us, it brings us under conviction, and we tend to say, no, I was as bad. In fact, I was worse. I mean, where there's some degree of relationship there, you know, most people are decent, good-willed individuals, and this just works. The opposite does not work as well as I think we sometimes think it will. If we can just kind of move on and slip through this, it doesn't usually work that way. So we need to apply the same medicine to ourselves that we recommend to others. And when we have been intentionally mean-spirited or have falsely blamed others, you know, for our unkindness, we're holding them, I was unkind because of you, you know, and saying, you know, it's their issue, not ours. Or we have been unintentionally insensitive and unaware of our unkindness, but we were rude nonetheless. Or, you know, we've been hostile and contemptuous due to, you know, unresolved personal issues in us, you know, from family of origin or whatever. I mean, you can lay it all out, but if the other person in some ways is feeling unloved and disrespected, then are we or are we not just simply going to say, hey, I was wrong, and make a confession? And we're going to look at four steps that really are necessary in the process of confession. Any questions at this point, Jonathan, on what I've said?
No, but I'm writing a few things down, and I may have some as we move forward here. So
thanks for that confession. Right, I appreciate that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Very transparent. Mm-hmm. The first thing, confession itself is loving and respectful, putting a chink in our crusty unkindness. In other words, I mean, it's a beautiful thing. I mean, if you just simply make confession, you're countering in some ways, although obviously, coming back to the point you're making, this would be on more the minor infractions, not like, committed adultery and I'm going to confess it and therefore it evens the score. The confession itself kind of brings us all back to zero and neutralizes. So in that sense, there are some serious situations that confession itself does not necessarily bring any healing. But in the day in and day out infractions, if I just confess to mom, I was unloving, or she confesses to me I was disrespectful, that's a very loving and respectful thing to do that neutralizes the very thing that we're acknowledging we did wrong. It really does kind of clear the air. It really is. It's a powerful thing. We don't use it as a technique just to neutralize it. And certainly other people pick up quickly if we're being superficial. But when mom says to me, I was disrespectful, I was wrong on that. I mean, it's kind of like, boy, that's honoring. I feel honored by that. That was nice. And or if I say, I was unloving again and I shouldn't have done that, she softens in her spirit. It just seems to ease her heart. It just removes the toxic moment from her spirit. There's a power here that's incredible. I mean, I've just seen it. Particularly women will say their spirit immediately softens when the husband simply confesses that he did something unloving. And they just soften. I remember when I was being interviewed on a national program in Canada, and the female host and facilitator was asking me, like, what are some things you do? I said, well, a husband needs to say, honey, I was wrong for being unloving. Will you forgive me? And I said, when a husband does that authentically, a woman's spirit softens and she just, all of that anger and hurt just goes out of her body. And the woman almost literally fell forward from the chair and she said, I'm softening right now just hearing you say that. I'm falling off my chair. That's unbelievable. There's power in this. So I want us to be encouraged. I think Fonz was fearful that somehow this was going to de-empower him when it really is not that at all. When the Lord tells us to confess, it's not because he's a cosmic killjoy out to ruin all of our relationships. He, I think, has a good insight in here to the fact that this will actually begin the healing process. So the confession to another that we spoke unkindly to them is the beginning of speaking kindly to them. Duh. But you know what? We kind of miss the obvious. The confession itself can make all things right. Such a kind confession can offset the earlier unkindness. The extent to which our unkindness made the other feel bad, our kind confession can make them feel good. Of course, and here's what some of us do. We scream unkindly. Okay, I'm sorry for my unkindness, okay? I've done that. That goes over like Led Zeppelin. It just doesn't work. It's a contradiction. The confession must be sincere and spoken in loving kindness. I think we all know that as mature adults, but I don't know about you, but I have this proclivity for immaturity and it comes out quick and it's kind of foolish when I step back and look at it. Another point, confession of our failure to love and respect triggers the beginning of change. Confession of our failure to love and respect triggers the beginning of a change. Jonathan, what does that say to you when you first hear it?
Well, it's a step in the direction of maturity. As you indicated earlier, it's difficult. Somebody has to do something with your confession, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they can run from it. They can blast you for it. They can respond in kind. And what you're saying is often it begins the process of softening towards each other, right? It can be a momentary change. We're redirecting in the context of this conversation, but I think these things done over and over again lead to more, permanent change where we go towards this intense place where we hurt each other less frequently. And when we do go there, we stay there for shorter duration.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Let's begin with that four-step process. It starts that important four-step process. Why don't you read the first one?
First step, we confess that the way we spoke was wrong. For instance, I was unkind. I was wrong. Obviously, this helps the other person when we acknowledge the hurt we brought to them. Confession is good for the soul, theirs and ours.
So the first, and it's kind of obvious, but, you know, it's amazing to me. And this is where the Fonz struggled, just simply saying, I was wrong. I mean, it is amazing to me, and you've probably seen it as well, Jonathan. I mean, there's a real fear that people have of saying I was wrong. I mean, it's just a paralyzing fear. It is very difficult for them to say, I was unloving. I was disrespectful. I was wrong. And it begins there. It just begins there.
Well, and I think beyond intimate relationships, and this isn't, you know, necessarily the topic, but where I've witnessed this the most widespread is inside the workplace, in the variety of places where I've worked. And I would, this may be exaggerated in terms of, you know, an absolute, but this is my observation. No one apologizes in the workplace. No one says they're sorry, whether that's to a fellow employee, to a boss, to somebody beneath you, or to another organization or somebody you're working with, you know, and people just don't say they're sorry. And so it was an interesting thing to me as I, you know, worked for many organizations in my late 20s and early 30s. Literally, I felt like I was the only person that ever said I was sorry about anything.
Well, and I remember you talking about that, because we've had in our family, you know, the importance of doing this. And so you just, I think, you know, we're trained to, hey, look, if you did something wrong, say it, and we move on, and we're good to go. I mean, that was part of our family, you know, culture. And I do remember now you saying, you know, nobody says that they're wrong. Why is that, in your estimation? What's going on?
Well, I think for the very reasons that you've stated, whether the Fonz or just in general. I mean, we're fearful. We have a tendency to self, you know, justify. We become entrenched in our position of, you know, if somebody, you know, moves towards me, I may move back towards them. But if they don't move, I'm not going to. You know, maybe we legitimately think we were right. Maybe we are poor at reading nonverbals and other signals that we've hurt somebody or you know, harmed them in some way. There's a variety of reasons, but it certainly, I believe, goes a long way when people do it.
Well, and I think you think politically. I mean, it is a rule of politics: never say you're wrong unless it's to your advantage, right? I mean, and that spilled over in a lot of areas. And there are people, I mean, there are philosophical perspectives, and we see it right now in this country. And as a country, it saddens me that you never say you're wrong. You just simply don't do that. You're always right, or there's always a reason for why you said it this way today and the opposite tomorrow. And, you know, you sometimes look back, you know, Abraham Lincoln and others, and, you know, are we losing something here? You know, are we losing something? It was Abraham Lincoln in this book I'm writing. He said, basically, he will always seek to be true, far and above than seeking to win. And you know, we have that view, I think, of Abraham Lincoln as an incredible man of character. I mean, obviously, no one's perfect, but there is this. Maybe I'm nostalgic that, you know, a man's word was as good as anything else, and you shook and so on. So, but today it's almost like I'm not going to say I'm wrong. And that has then kind of come into the business cultures, because if you do that, you're going to lose. If you say you're wrong, you're going to be discredited. If you say you're wrong, they're going to hold it against you. If you say you're wrong, you're going to come across as lacking confidence. And so there is this moment, I think many of us who follow Christ, you know, we have to find, you know what, I'm going to be true to myself. I'm going to be true to what happened. And if what I did was wrong, I'm going to say it was wrong, particularly if I came across in a very unloving and disrespectful way. And it seems to me that that's the better part of wisdom. If you're a leader in a company and you set the pattern there, hey, folks, I was wrong. I was angry at this report here. I was angry at what I thought was inefficiency. My reaction was wrong. The issues have to be addressed, but the way in which I reacted, I was out of line. And we're going to talk about how to step down through this process, but begin by simply saying, you know, I was wrong. I don't think you're going to lose credibility, in my opinion. That is huge. It is something that just endears us to people, and people want to follow that kind of individual. They trust that kind of individual.
So the first step is I was wrong, right?
Second step.
Step two. Step two, we confess and say something like, it was my fault. None of us can stand the person who apologized but adds a ton of excuses. I was unloving and disrespectful, but it's all your fault. They are not a puppet on a string mouthing out unkind remarks because we coerced them to speak this way. We must take the blame for what we did wrong.
And continue there.
By the way, we need not apologize for what they did wrong, but neither do we need to bring up what they did wrong. During confession, we leave that to them. Otherwise, they will think we confess to get them to confess. Mm. So, for instance, if the exchange turned heated and both were at fault 50-50, we own up to our 50% without saying a word about them owning up to their 50%. That's their responsibility. My response is my responsibility, and their response is their responsibility. This one seems tough to me.
Why?
I think the natural inclination, as you're suggesting that we resist, is to say, can I tell you why I reacted this way, you know, based on, you know, what you did or said? And this, you know, begs the question of, you know, in all episodes, right? I mean, that, you know, where we kind of approach this topic of, you know, how do we tell somebody that they've hurt us, right? How do we tell somebody that, you know, we felt like they said something that was unloving or disrespectful? I mean, and I guess what you're saying in this moment, at least, that's not the moment to do that.
Well, I think there's a nuance here, and it's an important one. I'm glad you highlighted that. You know, if mom and I have a conflict, you know, I can say, you know, that came across to me disrespectfully and I reacted, but you're not responsible for my reaction. I mean, I'm not holding you responsible. If I was like Christ, if I was a perfect person, I would have been very loving. I failed to be loving. This is my issue. I am saying the logic here is, here's what happened, but I'm not blaming you for that. I'm just simply saying, here's how it came across to me. Whether you intended that or not, that's how it appeared to me. But my reaction is wrong, and I'm responsible for that. So it's not like you play charades, that you go to a certain point, you say whatever it is that you've done, and then try to hint that maybe they've done something, but you better not say anything. But I am saying it's deeper for some of us. We actually say, look, I wouldn't have reacted this way had you not acted the way you acted. That's the fault finding that I'm saying, no, 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 no. Unless they've put nails through your hands and you cursed at them as they were hammering you to a cross. I mean, I'm going to give you some grace if there's physical torture going on, but this is nothing more than social ostracism from a good-willed person who perhaps was being defensive and insecure and said something to us they shouldn't. And then we went off half-cocked and went through the roof and somehow now say, I wouldn't have done that had you not said to me what you said. Whoa, whoa, whoa. No, untrue. Untrue. So that's the fault finding I'm talking about here. Now, are you at liberty to say to them, hey, you know, but here's how you reacted? Yeah, but we got to be very cautious. And I say at the beginning of this, if you haven't had this as part of your practice, just don't go there. Just don't go there. So just own up to your side of the equation and watch what happens. I think most of us get into the weeds on this and suddenly the other person says, you know what, your agenda really here is to place the blame on me. People are very suspicious of that. Even if you hint at it, they're going to interpret it that way. So I suggest at the beginning, just hold firm to this side. I mean, the point is you reacted wrongly. Now, if going forward, you know, you say it's incumbent upon them to know certain things here, you know, then yeah, you know, we need to be honest. But I think that each of us has to kind of know in our own spirit, you know, why am I saying this to them? Am I saying this to them for their sake, truly their sake? Or am I saying this because I'm trying to let them know that they are at fault for my reaction?
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, I think there's wisdom in not doing some of that, you know, in the moment. And certainly the way that you suggested could be very harmful, and how you said it is important to remember. And maybe revisiting it at a, you know, at a later time, right? In terms of the language we use. I mean, we're not in conflict at the moment, but we're talking about, you know, when you say things this way, right? I mean, it makes it, it, I end up feeling, you know, this way, and this is what I want to say, you know, back to you. How can we help each other, you know, stop this, you know, this pattern of interacting, right?
Yeah, that's very mature. No, that's very wholesome and very mature. And I think most who are mature people are listening and say, yeah, that's exactly right. But I'm saying there, and I know this stuff, and I know that I will quickly place blame on mom. It comes right out of me. It's there. It's amazing my ability to justify myself and blame her and say that I'm not at fault, that she is. And I know this stuff. So I'm, yeah,
trust me, I see it all the time between the two of you.
That's right.
That's a joke, audience.
Well, no, I mean, but it's I mean, it's not really a joke. It's there. And but my point is, I think I'm every man and mom's every woman. So if we know this stuff and we struggle with it, I think it's the better part of wisdom here to err on the side of caution. Don't be too quick to try to point out their mistake. I would say let's begin with just simply saying it's my fault and leave it alone. And I've said through the years, hey, if they are 50, and this is the deal. I mean, it's one thing to coach them on responding better, and that's the point I think you're making. How can we create win-win here? But there is also this idea that we have, if I point it out to them, it's going to bring them under conviction to change. And there could be some truth in that if they were completely in the dark on it, but most people are not. So what happens when we own up to our side and don't say anything to them, there is no more powerful way of heaping hot burning coals upon an individual. I mean, I've seen men who get humble before their wives and say, I was wrong on this. And her heart softens. You say, well, it wasn't you, it was me. It was far more me. In fact, I was really bad. I was horrible. I was rotten, you know. I mean, he doesn't have to point that out to her, particularly a husband toward a woman. Women are very sensitive of evening the score in the sense that they don't want to be above their husband. They want to be neutral with him. They want to be even with him. They don't like the idea that he's made confession and she hasn't. This is almost axiomatic in the female. So I say to guys, you don't have to point that out to her. I mean, she's got to be a pretty hard-hearted woman, or she's got to be so fearful and extremely insecure that she won't do that. But in the norm there, almost every woman I've met, she'll reciprocate quite quickly without you having to say anything.
Mm-hmm. So we've got the two comments of, it was my, I was unkind, I was wrong, it was my fault, and then step three. Number three, we seek forgiveness. We ask, will you forgive me? It isn't enough to tell a person we are sorry. They could retort, who cares that you are sorry? What about my feelings? Asking for forgiveness, not demanding it, lets them know we care about what they feel. They are in the driver's seat on forgiveness. We are hoping they will forgive and allow for a new beginning since they are the one who matters here. The offense came to them.
Mm-hmm. So just to say, you know, I'm wrong. It's my fault. Sorry. I mean, you know, sometimes that's okay. I mean, if it's a small infraction. But I mean, if we've really offended them, we need to ask the question. But many of us are afraid to do that because they'd say, no, I'm not going to forgive you. I mean, that is such a paralyzing fear that, you know, we avoid that. We don't even want to go there. But I remember learning years ago that, you know, it is crucial that you ask that question if the other person has truly been offended, and if we sense that they are resenting us, if they have an unforgiving spirit toward us, we can sense that they're not letting go of that. And this is something that we do as a gift to them as well. Not only do we need, you know, for them to forgive us, but they need to be put in a position whether they're going to or not. And asking that question is so important. And I remember years ago, Jonathan, all the kids would come to the neighborhood and play. We had everything going on in our backyard when you were younger, and mom always talks about the kids coming down and playing. And I remember something happened with one of the boys that was visiting in the neighborhood or something, and he was in the front yard. I still remember this, and I said, you know, will you forgive us? Will you forgive me? And he literally ran over to his bike, got on his bike, and rode off real quickly. And I'm thinking, man, that just frightened him. And I thought, that was an odd experience. But you know what? There are some people who, and he was immature, he'd never been in this. I don't know what was going on. I still am not able to pack that. But we need to put people in a position to decide whether they are or they aren't. And if we don't ask them, then they might not. But if we do ask them, now suddenly they realize, you know what? I do need to forgive. And you're giving them a gift. But you need to ask the question so they can deal with it, but that you can also know that they have, in fact, forgiven you and don't see the confession as superficial. And number four, unless you have a comment on that.
No, number four, we state, here's what I will do differently to communicate more lovingly and respectfully. The Bible teaches that there must be fruit in keeping with repentance. That's reasonable. We would expect someone who confesses to us to change course. If they confess to harsh speech but do nothing to change, the confession is pointless. Must we become perfect, never needing to confess again? Many of us wish to confess in order to be forgiven. We yearn inwardly to be clean. The wrongdoing truly bothers us. In the back of our minds, we know confession is good for the soul, but we also feel confession is pointless since there can be no real forgiveness apart from repentance. We feel it only right that we make an effort to stop that sin which we committed that demands the confession in the first place. We hear in our brain, you need to resolve not to sin again. Somehow that translates to us, be perfect from here on out. Of course, we know we cannot be perfect, so we give up on ourselves. Given perfection is the demand, who can go from imperfect to perfect? No one. Owning up to the past, seeking forgiveness, and resolving to communicate kindly does not mean we must walk on water as proof of our change. Yes, we must change, striving to speak perfectly today, but knowing we cannot become perfect on this side of paradise. We aim for perfection, but always recognize we will fall short, not as justification for our unloving and disrespectful speech, but to prevent us from feeling defeated and giving up altogether. We must live in the tension of two steps forward and one step back, without taking lightly our one step back, or giving up because of the one step back.
Mm-hmm. Read those two verses, and this illustrates the tension.
Matthew 5:48, therefore you are to be perfect, as your heavenly Father is perfect.
So there's the standard. Jesus tells us to be perfect, and that's the point. We all feel like, yeah, that's exactly what I'm called to be, and I can't be, so therefore this whole thing of confession, seeking forgiveness, you know, repentance, and keeping with my, I mean, I can't, so I'm not even going to go there because I've got to be perfect on the heels of all this, and I know I'm not going to be, so we then just kind of give up. And after all, Jesus tells us that we got to be perfect, although some translate that be mature. But nonetheless, we all kind of feel that call, hey, you know, be perfect. But now contrast that with what Paul said in Philippians 3:12.
Philippians 3:12. Not that I have already obtained it or have already become perfect, but I press on so that I may lay hold of that for which also I was laid hold of by Christ Jesus.
Mm-hmm. So Paul is saying, hey, I have not become perfect. I mean, so we live in this tension, you know, and so it is a challenge for all of us to realize, you know, there needs to be fruit in keeping with repentance. I mean, we all know that if I'm confessing every day, you know, sorry about slapping you across the face, sorry about that, hit him again tomorrow, sorry about that, apologize, will you forgive me, whack, the next day, whack. I mean, we all say, what a stupid illustration, that's exactly right, but it brings home the point that some of us feel, you know, what's the point in confessing if I'm just going to do it again? I've heard people say that. Well, because part of the confession and is the key to coming under this conviction that we need, and as we continue to do that over a period of time, you know what? We begin to stop those behaviors that we find unacceptable to ourselves. So the challenge is two steps forward, one back. Don't justify the step back, but don't be defeated by the step back. And there's a tension, and that's the tension of what I call maturity in Christ. It is what it is. And you've got to kind of times, you know, take it as a challenge. You know what? I got to stop this. But other times, if I start getting too defeated, I got to kind of give myself some grace.
Mm-hmm. Well, concluding comments for today's episode?
Yeah, I mean, read that psalm there, if you would.
Let the words of my mouth be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my rock and my Redeemer, Psalm 19:14.
So we know that the Lord wants our words, you know, to be acceptable in His sight. Ultimately, it isn't just toward my spouse. There is a vertical dimension here that, you know, that's what Jesus said, every careless word we have to give an account for. So part of our prayer is, Lord, let the words of my mouth be acceptable in Your sight. And many of us have perhaps heard that verse quoted in church. And we know that these unloving and disrespectful words toward others ultimately affects the heart of God. You know, I think of David when he committed adultery with Bathsheba in his Psalm 51, and also I think Psalm 32, he says, against thee and thee only have I sinned. And I often thought, well, what about, you know, Bathsheba's husband that he killed? What about Bathsheba? What about, you know, the baby? I mean, but he's saying comparably, you know, I mean, God's heart in all of this is so far more important. And so don't forget that part of this confession isn't just because you're trying to humble yourself before your spouse, let's say. You're also humbling yourself before God. And many of you have a tender relationship with the Lord, even though right now you don't necessarily like your spouse. You don't have that negative sentiment toward the Lord. So part of the incentive here is to make sure things are clean and clear between you and the Lord who loves you. And mm-hmm. say, let the words of my mouth be acceptable in your sight.
I know we're up against the time here, and I've got more than just two questions, and I don't even know if we have time for these two questions. And so, but maybe you could give the 30-second answer to each. And my first question is, someone saying they never, my spouse never apologizes. What do I do, or how do I get them, to apologize? Meaning, I'm assuming somebody might come from the framework of, I'm always saying I'm sorry. I'm always asking for forgiveness. And I try, to let that, be enough, but they never apologize. And then somebody else who says, my spouse always apologizes, but they never change.
Yeah, no, excellent questions. To the first, that's where another dimension here would be. When you make confession and they don't use that moment to point that out to them. But obviously the person is like the fawns. There's an insecurity here. They're cloaking it perhaps in an arrogance and an anger or a confidence, but they're a scared stiff. So you've got to see them as a little kid inside, and there's something that they're very afraid of. And we could have shamed them in the past. I don't know what the issues are. But I think on another occasion, listening to a podcast where we talk about how do you speak the truth in love? And that's where that principle applies. How do you communicate something to someone in that instance? But in this case, we're saying, you know what, you're not responsible for their confession. You're only responsible for yours. And that's the point of the topic today.
Mm-hmm. And then the second, maybe you did answer it, or maybe I wasn't paying attention.
Well, no, the person who's always saying they're sorry, this is some of the things in a male-female thing, husband-wife, some men. My wife's saying she's sorry every day, all the time, and she doesn't change. You hear that from men who say, one of the reasons I don't always confess is it's I got to change. I don't put, the stock in what I say. I put the stock in what I do, and that's noble. At the same time, you need to just verbally acknowledge to a woman, because women need to hear sometimes what you're feeling. They trust those words, and it's important. But the flip side, women need to understand that some of you are, you're not changing. You're just thinking, if I say I'm sorry, then we're good to go, but you do it again tomorrow. And this can drive some men nuts because it just seems so insincere, and the guy's just shut down. So again, if your wife or the other person is always saying, I'm sorry, but they don't change, again, in this case, it comes down to those podcasts where we talk about how do you speak the truth in love? How do you speak the truth respectfully to an individual who's not wanting to deal with the truth? In this instance, again, whether they're confessing to you all the time is really a moot point based on today's topic. We're really saying, what are you doing when you have done something wrong? And that's the parameter of our discussion mm-hmm. today. But I hear people asking that question, but don't dismiss what we said to you about you based on the person outside of you who doesn't confess or overly confesses.
Good. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Hope you have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to the Love and Respect Podcast. For more information and additional products, go to loveandrespect.com and follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Join Emerson and Jonathan next week for another episode.